Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. This is Reclaiming the Republic. It is now or never. That debt is fraud, and we do need to appeal to heaven. Please continue learning so that your prayers can be more concise, more succinct. And so let's kind of go forward together so that we're working together instead of kind of opposing, because that's worst thing that can happen is everybody goes down their own direction and we're not working, you know, together. Next, we have to basically focus on compliance to the Constitution. These committees we form, the call upon our public servants, and our own personal campaigns need to be centered on compliance to the Constitution. Ergo, I'm running a campaign to demand, as a presidential candidate, that the people choose the electors, not the party. Therefore, I'm asking people to start communicating to the state secretaries of state, because I believe the secretaries of state need to poke the state legislature in the eye and say, I believe the way the Constitution's written, you're violating it because you're to call place the fourth. When you look at Article 2 and the 12th Amendment, and it basically and clearly states that the state, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature may direct a number of electors and so forth, but they do not have the ability to basically determine the outcome, i.e. allowing the parties to determine who the electors will be. We the people, this has been covered several times, and we're going to do it again this year in the ratification debates. We the people are to choose our electors. And the problem is that the electors are to choose who is to be president, and the electors are to choose who will be vice president. So the contrived idea that the president gets to choose his own vice president is not constitutional. The contrived idea of party primaries being inflicted upon the candidates that are seeking their nomination or election by the electors, the fact that we have primaries to get rid of them is unconstitutional. Anyway, so learn, pray, act, and we need to start working and focusing on compliance of the Constitution. Now, welcome back, Tammy. Yesterday, we were actually diving into the discussion regarding the Constitutional Convention. And Madison was just about ready to pipe up. So one of the things that they had made a change was to change it to 3/4 of the states, of the several states, which was agreed to without contest. Now, Mr. Madison then moved to postpone of the amended proposition in order to take up the following. Go ahead.
The legislature of the U.S., whenever 2/3 of both houses shall deem necessary, or on the application of 2/3 of the legislatures of several states, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, which shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part thereof, when the same shall have been ratified by 3/4 at least of the legislatures of several states, or by conventions in 3/4 thereof, as one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by the legislature of the U.S.
Okay, so let me ask you, how close is that to what the final language of the Constitution is?
Pretty close.
Very close. As a matter of fact, what he just proposed was the concept of, and it's instead of it saying the legislature, it says the Congress. Whenever, this is what the Constitution says, so you can read along and go, wow, that's almost verbatim. The Congress, whenever 2/3 of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, or on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments which, in either case, shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states or by conventions in three-fourths thereof as the one or the other mode of ratification. So in other words, any constitutional convention would, any amendment that comes forward out of a constitutional convention or out of Congress can be directed to either be ratified by the state legislature or ratified by a mode of ratification, or by convention of three-fourths of the states. In other words, the way the United States Constitution was ratified by ratification convention. That's what they mean by that. So how close was that? Pretty close?
I'd say pretty darn close.
Okay. All right. I think that there were some subtle differences, but Madison really kind of vectored them in. Okay, so that moved forward by actually Mr. Hamilton seconded the motion, and Mr. Rutledge then wanted to go down into the Property Amendment Protection Clause. Okay? Okay. So let's go ahead and read. Mr. Rutledge said, go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Rutledge said he never could agree to give a power by which the articles relating to slaves might be altered by the states not interested in that property and prejudiced against it. In order to obviate this objection, these words were added to the proposition. Provided that no amendments which may be made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the 4 and 5th sections of the 7th article, the postponement being agreed to.
Okay, so the reason why this language is important, because they basically say the 4th and 5th sections of the 7th article. What is the 7th article of the Constitution? The 7th article is the ratification of the Constitution. So they're still using the original Articles of Confederation even to this day on the 10th of September.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So on the question, on the proposition of Mr. Madison and Mr. Hamilton, as amended, did it pass?
Yes.
Yes, it did. In other words, they successfully amended Article 5, what we call Article 5 of the Constitution, with an amendment protection clause. It's to make sure that an amendment could never come forward and take away the federal government's ability to shut down the slave trade. So Mr. Gary then moved. Go ahead.
Mr. Gary moved to reconsider Article 21 and Article 22, from the latter of which, for the approbation of Congress, had been struck out. He objected to proceeding to change the government without the approbation of Congress as being improper and giving just umbrage to that body. He repeated his objections also to an annulment of the Confederation with so little scruple or formality.
Okay, so he made those comments. Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Hamilton concurred with Mr. Gary as to the indecorum of not requiring the approbation of Congress, and considered this a necessary ingredient in the transaction. He thought it wrong also to allow 9 states, as provided by Article 21, to institute a new government on the ruins of the existing one. He proposed a better modification of the two articles, 21 and 22, that the plan should be sent to Congress in order that the same, if approved by them, may be communicated to the state legislatures, to the end that they may refer it to state conventions, either a legislature declaring that if the convention of the states should think of the plan ought to take effect among 9 ratifying states, the same should take effect accordingly.
Okay. So when you look at the very end of the Constitution, there's a formal language in the very end that the states of, and it identifies all of the states. These are the delegates, right? Mr. Hamilton from New York, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and then they list Mr. Hamilton from New York because he was the only delegate. And then so in other words, all of the delegates of the others basically agreed to this, but the only one from New York was Mr. Hamilton. And then they basically say the preceding Constitution be laid before the United States in Congress assembled, and that it is the opinion of this convention that it should be afterwards be submitted to a convention of delegates chosen in each state by the people thereof under the recommendation of its legislature for their assent and ratification. In other words, the people that are going to ratify the Constitution will be the delegates chosen by the people to go and ratify and debate the Constitution, not the state legislature. They knew this, and I'm surprised that the language really didn't come out as plainly as one would think, because they knew that the big states, the six states that vigorously debated it, would have done everything they could, and if it was in their power that it was sent to them directly, they would have rejected it. So because they couldn't reject it, basically the convention did this bypass by saying this needs to be ratified by the delegates of the people, not the state legislature, to determine if this new government being formed is of their approval, not the state legislature. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is where what they're talking about, Mr. Gary and Mr. Hamilton, the approbation of Congress. In other words, they're basically wanting to make sure that one, Congress approves, the Continental Congress approves of this and actually forwards it to the states so that the states do ratify in this very specific manner, that the state legislatures do not actually step into the ratification process, but the people, the delegates of the people in a convention will basically ratify it. So anyway, okay. So then we go to Mr. Gorham.
Mr. Gorham, some states will say that 9 states shall be sufficient to establish the plan. Others will require unanimity for the purpose. Why I can't say that word. And the different and conditional ratifications will defeat the plan altogether.
But you did a good job. And so he's pointing out that there are going to be some that actually are going to demand that it has to be unanimous. And he's basically saying, hey, these states are going to work their hardest to defeat this. So Mr. Hamilton then said,
no convention convinced of the necessity of the plan will refuse to give it effect on the adoption by 9 states. He thought this mode less acceptable than the one proposed in the article and would attain the same end.
Okay. Because bottom line, 9 states is just that step above, right? If you look at 13 states, what's 3/4 of 13? Let me get my math calculator in my head. And we go 13 divided by 9. And that gives you, you want to go 9 divided by 13. My bad. So that gives you 69%. It's under 3/4. 3/4 being 75%. So it's above 2/3, but it's below 3/4. So anyway, so they actually went a little bit down or went a little bit light instead of getting the 75% threshold. But that's okay. They basically did get 10 states to actually ratify. Actually, 11 states ratified instead of just 9. Because bottom line, if you get 9 states to basically adjoin and create this union, and let's say what states would be the states that would say, we don't want to do this. Maybe Virginia, maybe New York, and maybe Massachusetts and Rhode Island, those four states, right? The other nine would be in the Union. Well, it wouldn't take long for, you know, a lot of the, I'll just say, these other states recognizing that they need to be a part of the Union, or that they're, because all it's going to do is create four against one, because each state will be struggling to try to create an advantage for themselves over the Union in its trades, everything that it's doing. It's going to be printing its own money. The Union is actually going to be using gold and silver, and they'll be paying in gold and silver, which is what Europe would love to receive, instead of the script, or instead of playing with commodities like tobacco and so forth. So anyway, the way I see this actually playing out, the reason why New York ratified, we'll get this, get through this in the ratification debates, because Virginia actually stepped into the Union, New York did. They weren't going to be left out. And then the the last state that actually joined was, because let me see here, the 9th was New Hampshire, the 10th was Virginia, the 11th was New York, the 12th in the in 1790 is when North Carolina joined, and then I think it was like two years later when Rhode Island stepped in. So it wasn't until 1791, I think, when they stepped in. Anyway, the point being that, okay, they move forward realizing that even if you had two big states could not compete with this nine-state union. There was more people, there was more trade, there was more opportunity. They just couldn't see how they could move forward. So anyway, as we keep moving forward, Mr. Fitzsimmons remarked that the words "for their approbation," because basically they wanted to, you know, get their approval. He said, "I would like to see that struck out in order to save Congress from the necessity of an act inconsistent with the Articles of Confederation under which they held their authority." Now, Mr. Randolph, what did he say?
Mr. Randolph declared if no change should be made in this part of the plan, he should be obliged to dissent from the whole of it. He had from the beginning, he said, been convinced that radical changes in the system of the Union were necessary. Under this conviction, he had brought forward a set of Republican propositions as the basis and outline of a reform. These Republican propositions had, however, much to his regret, been widely and, in his opinion, irreconcilably departed from. In this state of things, it was his idea, and he accordingly meant to propose that the state convention should be at liberty to offer amendments to the plan, and that these should be submitted to a second general convention with full power to settle the Constitution finally. He did not expect to succeed in this proposition, but the discharge of his duty in making the attempt would give quiet to his own mind.
Okay, so this is the beginning of Mr. Randolph basically trying to sidestep moving forward, because I think he's starting to realize. Now, actually, when you look at the original plan that they proposed, there were real problems with it that were just unacceptable. One of those things being that the small states would not want to join the Union. And if he moved forward with the way the Virginia plan was, then it would have actually killed the deal. And so he starts moving down the path of basically saying, well, maybe what we need to do is allow the states to amend this Constitution, and then we'll have another convention to solidify everything. And all of a sudden, people realized how hard it was to actually convene, how hard it would be to get the exact same people in the following year or two to meet again, and then go through and pick up, you know, all of these types of changes and so forth. And so Mr. Wilson basically said he was against a reconsideration of any purposes which had been mentioned. Now, Mr. King, go ahead. What did he say?
Mr. King thought it would be more respectful to Congress to submit the plan generally to them than in such a form as expressly necessarily to require their approbation or disapprobation. Disapprobation. The assent of 9 states be considered as sufficient, and that it was more proper to make this a part of the Constitution itself than to provide for it by a supplemental or distinct recommendation.
Okay. And Mr. Gary?
Mr. Gary urged the indecency and pernicious tendency of dissolving in so slight a manner the solemn obligations of the Articles of Confederation. In 9 out of 13 can dissolve, if 9 out of 13 can dissolve the compact, 6 out of 9 will be just as able to dissolve the new one hereafter.
Okay. Mr. Sherman?
Mr. Sherman was in favor of Mr. King's idea of submitting the plan generally to Congress. He thought 9 states ought to be made sufficient, but that it would be best to make it a separate act in some such form as that intimidated by Colonel Hamilton than to make it a particular article of the Constitution.
Okay, intimated. And so let me go back up to Mr. Gary. So Mr. Gary was, you know, thinking that this is not a good idea. And he was pointing out that if 9 of 13 states can dissolve the compact, then this next Constitution, 6 could actually get out and dissolve that one as well. Now, the problem is, because the fundamental premise is, how is it that a state could secede from the Union? Because what he's talking about is that 6 states could actually step out from underneath the 9-state Union. What parameters would be required for a state to legitimately step out of the Union? I'll help you. I'll help you. So when we look at secession, a state or a party to a compact, when the compact is being violated by, in this particular case, the federal government that they create a creature to serve them. And that creature starts actually abusing them and doing things that they shouldn't be doing. And literally, in their eyes, is making violations that are both, you know, willful and meaningful. In other words, they're doing these things to cause harm, to assert more power, to assume, amass more power. So at that point, when the Constitution has been violated by the federal government, every state in the Union is free to actually step back or step out of the Union and say, look, the Constitution is being violated, and these are so material and so important that, you know, we're not going to be a part of this anymore. They can secede from the Union. That's a legal right. Madison clarified it in the Federalist Papers. He clarified it in the ratification debates, and he even clarified it in Madison's report on the Virginia resolutions, that a contract is bound. I mean, every line in that contract is dependent upon each other. If one is broken or one is violated, then it means that there's a series of other violations that will come from that. And therefore, if that's the case, then if it's willful and material, then a state can step out of that, their involvement or their agreement to that compact and say, we're not a part of this anymore. We're going to become sovereign all by ourselves. We'll be an island. We aren't a part of this. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is Mr. Gary is basically assuming that 6 can just leave. That in this particular case, now we'll bring this up when we come back, that in this particular case, the states that aren't joining the Union would be violating it, and that's not the case at all. So in other words, let me just bring it up because we're going to run out of time, and I hate doing that. So I will stop myself right here, and we will be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let's place full context to what Mr. Gary is saying. Gary is basically saying that these nine states are dissolving the Articles of Confederation because the Articles of Confederation are, you know, are sacred. And the problem is that none of the states were following the Articles of Confederation. They were creating their own currency. They were creating their own trade agreements. They were all doing what was best for them. They weren't paying their debt and so forth. So in other words, the states created a compact to create a Continental Congress, but they weren't giving Congress any support. They weren't doing the things that they all pledged that they would do. They all pledged that they would pay their share. And many of the states didn't and weren't. So in light of a compact that is actually failing because the parties are failing it, does a party then have the ability to step away? In this particular case, because the compact being defunct, being that Continental Congress didn't have compulsion authority, they couldn't force and compel the states to do what they're supposed to do. They couldn't call forth the militia to go into a state and say, you owe us taxes, you need to pay. So in other words, what Mr. Gary is basically talking about is that they had a pig with lipstick, and that's all it was. And they hid behind this pig with lipstick, and they were all able to be bad actors. And so the states were okay with that. The whole point of this convention was to fix the deficiencies of that Articles of Confederation. And because it required that one word that starts with U, unanimity, that they needed a unanimous agreement to an amendment, that right there was the death nail. Because Rogue Island, what they needed to do was they needed to actually create a whole new government without Rhode Island. And basically say, you know what, we're going to create a compact and we're going to make it so that one state can't hang us and leave us out to dry. And so, bottom line, everybody knew that they needed to make these very specific changes. So why is Mr. Gary all of a sudden coming down this, you know, I'll just say this high horse saying, oh, well, shoot, if we can violate, you know, that constitution, then six states could violate this. No. The only way that the six states would actually be able to step out from this union is if the federal government or the contract itself is being violated by the federal government. Congress was not the character violating the Articles of Confederation. The states were. The states were the problem. They've always been the problem. Nine times out of ten, the states have been the problem until the new age of globalism. Then the federal government basically started corrupting the states in getting them to violate the Constitution while the federal government started violating the Constitution. So that being said, Mr. Gary was really out of line for what he was saying, and he was creating a red herring. In other words, he was creating an argument, like a straw man argument, a red herring, where it couldn't be supported. If you're creating a union to do something very specific that would benefit the states, then why would the states get out of it? The only reason the Articles of Confederation, folks, you need to hear this. The only reason they were having this convention is because the states were failing the Articles of Confederation. And because right. they didn't want to amend it, they had how many amendments? We went through this. They had 8 standing amendments and not one could get passed. So what's the point? I mean, it's like you have to state the obvious. You have to acknowledge the elephant in the room. They created a document that made it easy for them to not fulfill their obligations and literally undermine the union as all of the states did. So they actually created commissions to give these guys the latitude to do what they thought was necessary in preserving the union in dealing with the exigencies of the time. So that's exactly what they were doing. And so Mr. Gary, I honestly think he was going out in left field. And so sometimes when people say that, you know, they seem like they're a part of this and everything was going along. And I'll give you some more history on this. We'll get into the ratification debates on this, but Mr. Gary was one of those from Massachusetts that did not sign the Constitution. And so when the ratification debates were being formed in Massachusetts and they were going to debate the Constitution for its ratification, excuse me, Mr. Gary was not elected by his constituents because his constituents wanted to ratify the Constitution. And because he refused, they didn't feel he would represent them. And so they chose somebody that would actually represent the Constitution to go and debate it. So during the convention, we'll get into this because I'll actually show it to you, that Mr. Gary is then called for and summoned by the anti-federalists in the convention because they wanted him to be there to testify bad things about the Constitution. Mr. Gary, at that point, because he came in, he actually reported for one day. It took a little while for him to get there, but after he got there, excuse me, they had these questions for him. And there's no doubt in my mind, Mr. Gary, being a creature of survival, recognized that he had put himself into a corner. He painted himself into a corner. How did he do that? His constituents wanted the Constitution. If he was ever going to be elected, he would actually need to become either an advocate for the Constitution or this Constitution really needed to be rejected, and he couldn't participate. So when he showed up, when the anti-federalists said, we want to call this man in because he is a material witness to the convention to talk about the impropriety actions of the convention and the delegates. And so Mr. Gary shows up, and then the next day he goes AWOL because he finally realizes that he can't bite the hand that feeds him. He knows that if he's going to have any political career, he either has to move out of the area of Massachusetts where he lives, and that's not easy back in those days, or he has to change his tune and start singing the song that his constituents want, like a real Republican, you know, government. And so he went AWOL for the entire ratification debates. After that, didn't bear testimony once, and so he didn't bolster or support the anti-federalist arguments, which basically made way for the Constitution to actually get ratified. Now, I pointed this out to the audience that I don't think you're privy to, that Samuel Adams going into the convention, he didn't want to go down to the Constitutional Convention with everybody else because he thought this wasn't needed. We don't need another constitution, a new government. So he basically says, I'm not going to go. So he was at the ratification debates, and he was against it until a certain point where Hancock stepped up and said, let's do this. And then Samuel Adams goes, that's brilliant. That is so brilliant. I now support this. And he actually voted for the ratification of the Constitution. Anyway, too much stories, too much history. So let's move on down to Mr. Hamilton, because I think we just read with Mr. Sherman's response. And on the question reconsidering the two articles, no, yes, yes, no, yes, 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 yes. So it carried with the yes. And so Mr. Hamilton then moved. Go ahead.
Then moved to postpone Article 21 in order to take up the following, containing the ideas he had above expressed, resolved that the foregoing plan of the Constitution be transmitted to the U.S. in Congress assembled, in order that if the same shall be agreed to by them, it may be communicated to the legislatures of the several states, to the end that they may provide for its final ratification by referring the same to the consideration of a convention of deputies in each state to be chosen by the people thereof, and that it be recommended to the said legislatures in their respective acts for organizing such convention to declare that if the said convention shall approve of the said constitution, such approbation shall be binding and conclusive upon the state, and further that if the said convention should be of opinion that the same upon the assent of any 9 states thereto ought to take effect between the states so assenting, such opinion shall thereupon be also binding upon such state, and the said constitution shall take effect between the states assenting thereto.
Okay, so he's basically laying out the changes to moving the Constitution to Congress and then to the state's ratification, that he wants to kind of clean up that little language in that paragraph that's not a part of the article. It's a part of basically instructions to Continental Congress. Okay, so Mr. Gary seconded the motion of Mr. Hamilton. Then Mr. Wilson then basically said, the motion being seconded, go ahead.
It is necessary now to speak freely. He expressed in strong terms his disapprobation of the expedient proposed, particularly the suspending the plan of the convention on the approbation of Congress. He declared it to be worse than folly to rely on the concurrence of the Rhode Island members of Congress in the plan. Maryland has voted on this floor for requiring the unanimous assent of the 13 states to the proposed change in the federal system. New York has not been represented for a long time past in the convention. Many individual deputies from other states have spoken much against the plan. Under these circumstances, it can be safe to make the assent of Congress necessary. After spending 4 or 5 months in the laborious and arduous task of forming a government for our country, we are ourselves at the close throwing inseparable obstacles in the way of its success.
Ah, very insightful. Mr. Wilson of Pennsylvania was really throwing it out there that said, we need to make this the irresistible object. So he basically pointed out that Rhode Island didn't participate. Maryland had basically, you know, on this floor voted and wanted to maintain unanimity, a full agreement of everybody. Now, that wasn't within their commission. There was only one state that had that in their commission, and I believe it was Massachusetts. So when we look at, you know, what was in the commissions and so forth, and we look at what is being thrown out here by Mr. Gary, he's really kind of laying it out to say that we need to make sure that the way this goes out and gets presented, that it has the best chance of success. Okay? So Mr. Clymer thought that the mode presented by Mr. Hamilton would fetter and embarrass Congress as much as the original one, since it equally involved a breach of the Articles of Confederation. Mr. King then said this. Go ahead.
Mr. King concurred with Mr. Clymer. If Congress can accede to one mode, they can to the other. If the approbation of Congress be made necessary, and they should not approve, the state legislatures will not propose the plan to conventions. Or if the states themselves are to provide that 9 states shall suffice to establish a system, that provisions will be omitted. Everything will go into confusion and all our labor be lost.
Okay, so in some ways, I think these guys, some of these men were being more defeatist and having less faith. Right? So Mr. Rutledge, he viewed the matter. I'll go ahead and read it. He viewed the matter in the same light with Mr. King on the question to postpone in order to take up Colonel Hamilton's motion. And so did it pass? One eye. Connecticut. Okay. A question being then taken on Article 11, it was agreed to unanimously. Okay, so Colonel Hamilton withdrew the remainder of the motion on Article 12, observing that his purpose was defeated by the vote just given. Okay, so Mr. Williamson and Gary moved together to reinstate the words for the approbation or for the agreement of Congress in Article 12, which was disagreed to without any contest. In other words, boop, they just disagreed with it completely. Then Mr. Randolph, being the consummate politician, stepped in to basically say this. Go ahead.
Mr. Randolph took this opportunity to state his objections to the system. They turned on the Senate's being made the court of impeachment for trying the executive on the necessity of 3/4 instead of 2/3 of each house to overrule the negative of the president on the smallest of the number of the representative branch. On the want of limitation to a standing army, on the general clause concerning necessary and proper laws, on the want of some particular restraint on navigation acts, on the power to lay duties on exports, on the authority of the general legislature to interpose on the application of the executives of the states, on the want of a more definite boundary between the general and state legislatures, and between the general and state judiciaries, on the unqualified power of the president to pardon treasons, on the want of some limit to the power of the legislature in regulating their own compensations. With these difficulties in mind, what course, he asked, was he to pursue? Was he to promote the establishment of a plan which he verily believed would end in tyranny? He was unwilling, he said, to impede the wishes and judgment of the convention, but he must keep himself free in case he should be honored with a seat in the convention of his state to act according to the dictates of his judgment. The only mode in which his embarrassments could be removed was that of submitting the plan to Congress to go from them to the state legislatures and from these to the state conventions, having power to adopt, reject, or amend. The process to close with another general convention with full power to adopt or reject the alterations proposed by the state conventions and to establish finally the government. He accordingly proposed a resolution to this effect.
Okay, so what is he hooking his star to? Or what is he hooking himself to? He's basically tying himself to something that is necessary for him to be behind this in supporting the Constitution. And he says, the only mode in which his embarrassments could be removed was that of submitting to the plan to Congress to go from them to the state legislatures and from these states to state conventions having power to adopt, reject, or amend. The process to close with another general convention with full power to adopt or reject the alterations proposed by the state conventions and to establish finally the government, he accordingly proposed a resolution to this effect. In other words, the one thing that he wanted was he wanted to actually revisit the entire Constitution after the states chewed on it and provided their views of recommendations or their views of amendments. So we go on and on and on. But this is where he makes that ultimate layout that this is, you know, my approval, my signing this Constitution is contingent upon these very, very specific things. And so as we continue down forward, we'll notice on Wednesday the 12th, right? This is where Article 1 gets laid out with Sections 1, 2, and 3. In other words, this is where, and actually let me point out, from this Committee of Style, etc., reported the digest plan. In other words, after the 10th of September, right? That's where we just had these conversations. On September 12th, so September 11th, the report of the committee and style arrangement not being made and being waited for, they adjourned. So in other words, they had the Committee of Style had one day to basically cut up the Constitution and create this new formation of seven articles versus how many, 20 some odd? So they went down that path of doing that, and then they went through the language of the Constitution. This is the final language of the Constitution that we're going to see here. And so let's go down to Article 4, Section 3. This was the final conclusion of admitting states, which is exactly what we see today. So go ahead and read it. Of admitting new states into the Union. Okay, so it's the admission of new states underneath Doc Johnson. Wednesday, September 12th, in the navigation pane. So Mr. Johnson's kind of reading through the entire Constitution, and you're going to just read what he read for Section 3 of Article 4. Go ahead.
Just from the committee of that? No.
So, okay, so you got to go a ways down because they're reading the entire Constitution here. And this is on page 447. So if you're looking at the navigational pane, you see Wednesday, September 12th, you see Doc Johnson, and then the next step down is the admission of new states. That is Article 4, Section 3. Go ahead.
Okay. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this Union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of the Congress. The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory of other property belonging to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state.
So there's no diminishment. There's no, you know, reducing the sovereignty and power of a state joining the Union that they talked about at the very beginning and tried to cling on to. They finally conceded that all states joining the Union come in with equal footing, that they all have full control over everything within their boundary, other than those few things like forts, arsenals, and so forth that the federal government or Congress shall pay for. Okay? So, let's jump down to the Amendment Protection Clause, and let's go ahead and read this right here. Now, just read the whole part where it says Amendment Protection Clause. The Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses deemed... This is actually Article 5. They're reading it. We're highlighting the Amendment Protection Clause, and I'm trying to show... Well, go ahead and read it, and then I'll tell you what I'm showing.
Okay. The Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem necessary, or on the application of two-thirds of the legislatures in several states, shall propose amendments to this Constitution, but shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part thereof, when the same shall have been ratified by three-fourths at least of the legislatures of the several states, or by conventions in three-fourths thereof, as the one or the other mode of ratification may be proposed by the Congress, provided that no amendment which may be made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the blank and the blank section of blank article.
There you go. So they were still working on what those sections and so forth that it was going to fall into. So they kind of left that blank, but they knew they needed to come back and actually identify where the article, section, and subsection was that couldn't be changed to ensure that the Constitution could not be amended that allowed the continuation of the slave trade. That must end, right? Because that was the agreement made. Okay. So as we move forward, and we're going to go down, 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 we're going to actually find that there's a comment regarding the militia and changes to this on Friday, September 14th, and it'll be down under Mr. Governor Morris. It basically is a subtitle, The Militia, where Mr. Mason begins speaking to some details regarding the militia that is being put into the Constitution, the language thereof. So let's, did you find it? It's down on page 459. Yeah. Okay.
So Colonel Mason?
Mm-hmm. It's in blue, right?
Okay. Uh-huh. Yep.
Okay.
So Colonel Mason, being sensible that an absolute prohibition of standing armies in time of peace might be unsafe, and wishing at the same time to insert something pointing out and guarding against the danger of them, moved to preface the clause, Article 1, Section 8, to provide for organizing and arming and disciplining the militia, and etc., with the words, and that the liberties of the people may be better secured against the danger of standing armies in time of peace. And Mr. Randolph seconded the motion.
Ah, so now Randolph is, okay, being the, at this point he becomes the, like I said, the consummate or the epitome of a politician. Mr. Madison was in favor of it. It did not restrain Congress from establishing a military force in time of peace if found necessary, and as armies in time of peace are allowed on all hands to be an evil, it is well to discontinuance them by the Constitution as far as will consist with the essential powers of the government on that head. Okay? So, I guess the words, and that the liberties of the people may be better secured against the danger of standing armies in the time of peace. That's what he wanted, and it didn't make the cut. Morris and Madison, or I should say Randolph, seconded it, and Madison even favored it. Mr. Morris said this. Go ahead.
Mr. Morris opposed the motion as setting a dishonorable mark of distinction on the military class of citizens.
Okay, keep going. Go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Pinckney and Mr. Bedford concurred in the opposition on the question.
Wow. So, folks, we just wrapped up. So we'll wrap up with all of this when we come back. Now, as we move forward, we're going to wrap up tomorrow, and we will probably prepare for the ratification phase because that's how close we are going through the notes. It is that close to getting into my favorite time where we dive into the ratification base. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
You should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.